Attention listeners, AfterSight's annual hike is coming up on July 27th.
It was a really good experience for me.
Visit aftersight.org/hike and become an audio trekker today.
That hike today gave me so much courage.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for news from the Tuesday Loveland Reporter Herald. My name is Jean Pazur. Historic New York hush money trial starts. Prosecutor says Trump tried to affect 2016 results. Defense says ex-president did not commit crimes. Donald Trump tried to illegally influence the 2016 presidential election by preventing damaging stories about his personal life from becoming public, a prosecutor told jurors Monday at the start of the former president's historic hush money trial. This was a planned, coordinated, long-running conspiracy to influence the 2016 election to help Donald Trump get elected through illegal expenditures to silence people who had something bad to say about his behavior, using doctored corporate records and bank forms to conceal those payments along the way, prosecutor Matthew Colangelo said. It was election fraud, pure and simple. A defense lawyer countered by assailing the case as baseless and attacking the integrity of the one-time Trump confidant who is now the government's star witness. President Trump is innocent. President Trump did not commit any crimes. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office should never have brought this case, attorney Todd Blanche said. The opening statements offered the 12-person jury and the voting public radically divergent roadmaps for a case that will unfold against the backdrop of a closely contested White House race in which Trump is not only the presumptive Republican nominee, but also a criminal defendant facing the prospect of a felony conviction and prison. In the first criminal trial of a former American president and the first of four prosecutions of Trump to reach a jury, befitting that history, prosecutors sought from the outset to elevate the gravity of the case, which they said was chiefly about election interference, as reflected by the hush money payments to a porn actor who said she had a sexual encounter with Trump. The defendant, Donald Trump, orchestrated a criminal scheme to corrupt the 2016 presidential election. Then he covered up that criminal conspiracy by lying in his New York business records over and over and over again, Colangelo said. The trial, which could last up to 2 months, will require Trump to spend his days in a courtroom rather than on the campaign trail, a reality he complained about Monday when he lamented to reporters after leaving the courtroom, "I'm the leading candidate and this is what they're trying to take me off the trial for, checks being paid to a lawyer." Trump has nonetheless sought to turn his criminal defendant status into an asset for his campaign, fundraising off his legal jeopardy and repeatedly railing against the justice system that he has for years claimed is weaponized against him. In the weeks ahead, the case will test the jury's ability to judge him impartially, but also Trump's ability to comply with courtroom protocol, including a gag order barring him from attacking witnesses, jurors, trial prosecutors, and some others. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records, a charge punishable by up to 4 years in prison, although it's not clear if the judge would seek to put him behind bars. A conviction would not preclude Trump from becoming president again, but because it is a state case, he would not be able to pardon himself if found guilty. He has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing. The case brought by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg revisits a years-old chapter from Trump's biography when his celebrity past collided with his political ambitions, and prosecutors say he scrambled to stifle stories that he feared could torpedo his campaign. Opening statements served as an introduction to the colorful cast of characters that feature prominently in that tawdry saga, including Stormy Daniels, the porn actor who says she received the hush money, Michael Cohen, the lawyer who prosecutors say paid her, and David Pecker, the tabloid publisher who agreed to function as the campaign's eyes and ears, and who served as the prosecution's first witness on Monday. Pecker is due back on the stand Tuesday, when the court will also hear arguments on whether Trump violated Judge Juan Merchan's gag order with a series of Truth Social posts about witnesses over the last week. In his opening statement, Colangelo outlined a comprehensive offer by Trump and his allies to prevent three separate stories, two from women alleging prior sexual encounters, from surfacing during the 2016 presidential campaign. That undertaking was especially urgent following the emergence late in the race of a 2005 Access Hollywood recording in which Trump could be heard boasting about grabbing women sexually without their permission. Within days of the Access Hollywood tape becoming public, Colangelo told jurors that the National Enquirer alerted Cohen that Stormy Daniels was agitating to go public with her claims of a sexual encounter with Trump in 2006. At Trump's direction, Cohen negotiated a deal to buy Ms. Daniels' story in order to prevent American voters from learning that information before Election Day, Colangelo told jurors. But, the prosecutor noted, neither Trump nor the Trump Organization could just write a check to Cohen for $130,000 with a memo line that said reimbursement for porn star payoff. So he added, they agreed to cook the books and make it look like the payment was actually income, payment for services rendered. Those alleged falsified records formed the backbone of the 34-count indictment against Trump. Trump has denied a sexual encounter with Daniels. Blanche, the defense lawyer, sought to preemptively undermine the credibility of Cohen, who pleaded guilty to federal charges related to his role in the hush money scheme, as someone with an obsession with Trump who cannot be trusted. He said Trump had done nothing illegal when his company recorded the checks to Cohen as legal expenses. There's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It is called democracy, not a crime, Blanche said. Blanche challenged the notion that Trump agreed to the Daniels payout to safeguard his campaign. Instead, he characterized the transaction as an attempt to squelch a sinister effort to embarrass Trump and his loved ones. President Trump fought back like he always does, and he's entitled to do to protect his family, his reputation, and his brand, and that is not a crime, Blanche told jurors. The first and only witness Monday was Pecker, the then publisher of the National Enquirer and a longtime Trump friend who prosecutors say met with Trump and Cohen at Trump Tower in August 2015 and agreed to help Trump's campaign identify negative stories about him. Pecker described the tabloid's use of checkbook journalism, a practice that entails paying a source for a story. Playground is a huge step for the city. Parks and Rec breaks ground on Willow Bend Park and Natural Area. The adaptive Willow Bend Park and Natural Area is no longer just an aspiration in the city's 10-year master plans. On Monday, Loveland Parks and Recreation hosted a groundbreaking ceremony for the first-of-its-kind hybrid facility that will offer unprecedented recreation opportunities to visitors of all abilities. "You know it's real when the big yellow equipment shows up," said acting Loveland City Manager Rod Wentz in remarks to the crowd, referring to the earth-moving machines already at work at the site. "You can talk about it all you want, but it's real when that shows up." Wensing was joined at the ceremony by more than city staff members and others involved in the project. Also on hand was Loveland Mayor Jackie Marsh, who called the groundbreaking a momentous day in Loveland and thanked the Parks and Recreation staff who recognized the need for a place like Willow Bend and then worked for more than a decade to make it happen. "So many people had a piece of designing and making this come to life," Marsh said. "It's a huge step for Loveland, and I'm so proud and honored to be part of your team." The Willow Bend project has been on the city's wish list since 2014, and in 2016, it started acquiring property for it at 2538 East 1st Street. With two other recent acquisitions in the area, the city now owns a total of 163 acres stretching west to Boise Avenue. Willow Bend's main feature will be a large universal access playground with equipment and features accessible to visitors with physical, cognitive, or emotional disabilities. "But not only for those users," said Will Coleman, a senior associate landscape architect with the project's designer, Dig Studio Incorporated. Following the ceremony, he explained that the Willow Bend Playground was designed with all users in mind, even those outside the typical playground age group. "Not everyone who plays here is going to be a child," Coleman said following the ceremony. "There will be adults with special needs and adult caregivers, and so we're making sure that we're thinking about this multi-generationally. The goal," added Dig Studio President Lauren Rains, "was to make Willow Bend not just accessible, but also exciting to all ages and abilities. And that is really not easy to do," she said. "The park will also have accessible amenities, including paved walking paths, shade shelters, a picnic plaza, and year-round restrooms with running water and oversized stalls. Next to the playground will be a multi-purpose sports park where grading is currently underway. Ashley Taylor, recreation manager for the city, is looking forward to the expanded adaptive sports opportunities such fields will provide in Loveland. It's an underserved demographic in what we're able to offer. So for us to be able to tap into that will be key to engaging more," Taylor said. "A lot of people end up going to other places for the service that now we'll be able to provide here in Loveland. The natural portion of the site will extend south toward the Big Thompson River with a separate parking lot and more restrooms. From there, a trailhead will connect with ADA accessible trails to the river and a fishing dock. The area will also be connected to the Boise Bend Natural Area by a 1.3-mile segment of the East Big Thompson Trail, which will be under construction this summer. The total costs for the Willow Bend project are expected to be $8.6 million, but none of that will be from Loveland's general fund," said Wensing. "The bulk of the funding, $6.4 million, is coming from capital expansion fees, which developers pay as part of the city permitting process. The remainder is coming from state and federal grants. Construction is expected to last 10 months, weather permitting, and the park should be open to visitors about this time next year," said Parks and Recreation Planning Manager Brian Harding. A longtime member of the Willow Bend project team, he is most looking forward to seeing the completed playground, but he's also looking forward to seeing a decade of planning, strategizing, and hard work come together in a legacy project that will bring a much-needed new asset to Loveland. Whether it was budget constraints or COVID, there are a few times when things looked a little questionable, Harding said, but everybody kept at it, so it all came together. Politics. Bennett, Gardner talk bipartisanship. Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, a Democrat, and former Senator Cory Gardner, a Republican, shared on stage at Colorado State University's Laurie Center, where they discussed bipartisanship and working across the aisle. Before the presentation could begin, protesters demanding a ceasefire in Gaza disrupted the event for a handful of minutes. "Stop funding Israel," one shouted, prompting a sigh from Colorado State University President Amy Parsons. "Anybody else?" she asked after protesters were escorted from the room to chuckles from the crowd. "We are a public university. We encourage people debating and protesting and being passionate about what they believe in, and this is an example of that." Bennett addressed the protesters briefly, pointing to the First Amendment. "Thank goodness we have a First Amendment. Thank goodness we live in a place where people feel like they can raise their voice like that, or raise their voice in a meeting like this and disagree. I hope, and not feel like they're going to end up in jail or a prison cell, which is the way it happens in a lot of parts of the world," he said. "Today we really don't have that here, but we do have to worry about whether they're going to be canceled, or if they say one thing and it's not popular, and it's going to be the end of the discussion." The two senators only alluded to the conflict in the Middle East for the rest of the hour-long discussion, although Bennett did say he was glad to see protests in the United States as an indicator that young people are engaged in the political system. They did touch more heavily on the war in Ukraine, which both characterized as an assault on democracy. "If the tyranny of Vladimir Putin is defeated in Ukraine, that is a major victory, not just for the United States, but for freedom around the globe," Gardner said. "I hear people and I understand it. They say, how can you dare fund the border in Ukraine but not the border in the United States? That's an argument we hear. We are not a nation that can do more than one thing at a time." "Exactly," said Bennett in response. The two senators also addressed the topic of political polarization in their talk. "Building bridges, bipartisan perspectives on democracy," that was part of CSU's thematic year of democracy. "I'd first say that I don't think people are as polarized as some people who have come here and said that," Bennett told the audience. "I think we're facing polarizing forces. The collapse of print media, the collapse of newspapers, the rise of social media has had a profound effect on polarization, creates a lot of that polarization. Most people in this country don't have time to be polarized." He continued by saying that most people are too busy going to school, working a job, or raising children to be too greatly impacted by polarization, and pointed to the old Schoolhouse Rock segment about how a bill becomes a law. "I think the American people deserve to have that be the standard of how Congress works, the description of that, how a bill becomes a law, and then be able to go about their business, raising their families, serving on school boards, doing the other kinds of things they do." Harrington Arts Alliance, former director pleads guilty. Grimm given 3-year deferred sentence for misdemeanor charge. Brittany Grimm, the former executive director of the previously named Harrington Arts Alliance, has pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge and given a 3-year deferred sentence. Grimm, 36, appeared before 8th Judicial District Court Judge Joseph Findlay for a continued disposition hearing Monday, 1 week after she was expected to enter a guilty plea. During the hearing, following the impact statements of several people, Grimm pleaded guilty to unauthorized use of a financial device, a Class 1 misdemeanor. Northern Colorado Performing Arts Board, formerly HAA, accused Grimm late last year of embezzling money that was spent on various personal items. This accusation resulted in Grimm being charged with 2 counts of theft between $20,000 and $100,000, and unauthorized use of a financial device, resulting in $20,000 to $100,000, both Class 4 felonies. Victim statements. During last week's hearing, Findlay decided to push the case out to allow for more people to share their thoughts after David Feltz, director of operations for Northern Colorado Performing Arts, spent about 20 to 30 minutes voicing his concerns. Feltz, in his statement to Findlay during the April 15th hearing, claimed that Grimm and her family stole $100,000 from the organization out of greed and self-indulgence. He claimed that Grimm had used this stolen money to buy a range of items, from clothing and children's toy to hotel stays and airline tickets. He claimed some of the money was used for personal vacations, including a stay at Great Wolf Lodge in August of 2021 that cost $1,700. She concealed these purchases by skimming money off the top of our ticket sales and production fees, he said during the April 15th hearing, later adding, "It sickened me to even think about how much good we could have done with that $100,000 that went directly to Ms. Grimm and her family's pockets." Feltz leveled frustration against Deputy District Attorney Matthew Pring and the 8th Judicial District Attorney's Office as well, in claiming they did not notify the Performing Arts Board about any plea negotiations. He also took issues with the proposed restitution amount of $48,000 that Grimm would have to pay, saying it made up less than half of the allegedly stolen $100,000. "I always thought crime didn't pay, but it looks like it does," he said. During Monday's follow-up hearing, Findlay first heard from Kelby Siegfried, Director of Community Relations for NOCOPAH, who, like Feltz, expressed frustration with the plea agreement and asked Findlay to throw it out. He said the agreement was reached without the board's input, describing it as an unfair, unjust, watered-down plea agreement. Siegfried said the board had requested data on cases the DA had pursued with similar charges, finding that out of 407 cases since January 2020, only 6 resulted in a deferred sentence. He said this proved the agreement was patently inconsistent with its leniency. "We ask that you exercise your authority and make an independent judgment in deciding to reject this plea agreement," he said. Following this, Ryan Marcus, one of Grimm's attorneys, called up several witnesses to speak on behalf of Grimm, including former Grant Whiting volunteers, other Harrington family members, and actors and actresses who were parts of HAA. Nancy Garcia, who was a volunteer grant writer and fundraiser for HAA since 2015, described Grimm as one of the brightest, most hardworking, honest, and competent professionals I've ever worked with. She said she had given both cash donations to HAA over the years, including a no-interest $35,000 loan to help the Harrington family buy the building they operated on North Denver Avenue, adding she had yet to see any payment plan from the current board and felt blindsided. Brittany sacrificed paycheck after paycheck at HAA so it could remain open for all of us, said Anna Perry, who described herself as a county resident and former member of the Art Alliance. Brittany is such a strong leader who sets such a strong example of what it means to be a leader to all of us. Marissa Dominguez, Brittany's older sister, also spoke on the way the case had impacted the family, saying she was heartbroken to see the board ban the Harringtons from the building, a place she went to feel a connection to their father, who died several years ago. I myself humbly thank Brittany for all she has endured, she said, all the work she's done to create a space that my family found so much joy in. She also added that she had worked to secure a $200,000 Medicaid grant for HAA, saying no one knows where those funds went. The board lady later told the Reporter Herald in a written statement that it had to work to obtain the money from Grimm and noted the organization has worked with the grantor to ensure all funds are used appropriately. Findlay also received 50 letters from both sides on the issue. Thank you for joining us for news from the Tuesday Loveland Reporter Herald. My name is Jean Passour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.